Page 106 of The Unfolding is the story of Esther Lee.
That's where I did a lot of crying out to God. I would put Ava to sleep and I would go into the bathroom and I would just lay on the floor and just pour out my heart before God. That's when I felt so near to the Lord, just like as if he was right there next to me on that hospital floor.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in The Unfolding.
Hey, this is Meredith Foster. Maybe you've got a mental list like this. God, here are the trials I can handle, and here are the hard things that I never could. Just protect me from those. Esther Lee longed for a comfortable life, following Jesus, yes, but living on her terms. And her terms were that nothing terrible would happen to her family or her kids. She was like many of us, equating suffering with God leaving us. So when her daughter Ava got very sick, it felt like God had abandoned her. How do you face pain and suffering when you've lost your trust in God?
I came to faith very early on. I actually don't even remember because my parents were giants of the faith. They really loved the Lord and they taught us how to love God. And then I went to college and again, just really went to a church that kind of continued to grow my faith and help me to seek out opportunities to serve God and love God. And so that was sort of my whole story, just kind of not a lot of hardship, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Very smooth sailing for a large part of my life. And then I met my husband. He went to Moody Bible Institute, and we just happened to meet at a church event once. And so we decided to pursue the relationship with each other and got married. He was serving the Lord and I was teaching, but I was also a pastor's wife. And for me, I think that didn't really feel any different just because, I wasn't really doing anything more than, I guess what I'm trying to say is I wasn't the greatest pastor's wife. I wasn't like super involved.
You weren't an overachiever.
No, I was not. I just kind of, I did my part. I just tried to support him. I was teaching at the time, so I'm kind of busy with my own career. Mm-hmm. And I think in my mind, I imagined that my life would just continue to be easy, but also serving God, because that part is not always easy. But I thought that would be sort of how my life went, where the most difficulty I would have is just in the ministry, the different things that happen in ministry. That's sort of what I guess the plan I had for my life. And then, of course, in my plan, I had envisioned, children, and it would be so perfect and so wonderful. Then I had Ava, and it really was so perfect and so wonderful. She was such an amazing little girl. Even when strangers would meet her, they would always comment on how articulate she was, how joyful she was, how patient and sweet she was. And so I just thought that was normal. I thought,
this is a typical baby.
Yeah, typical baby. Mm-hmm. This is just how it is to raise a child, just very easy. And so we went along with that. And then kind of soon after she was born, we started to notice that she had a lot of eczema and then some food allergies started to appear. That's when my life started becoming a little bit more difficult, where I was like, this is hard. Having a baby with food allergies is really difficult. I remember when she started having eczema on her face, I started looking up what this might be. And I started seeing a lot of different images of children with severe eczema. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, oh, God, no, I can't do that. She can have a little bit of eczema, but not a lot. And then turned out she had really severe eczema as the months went on. And so we sought out allergists and dermatologists, and things got increasingly more difficult in terms of caring for her.
Were her food allergies the type that could be life-threatening? Was
yes.
it? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's devastating,
yeah.
isn't it?
It was really hard. I would accidentally give her something and then she would projectile vomit, and then it would appear as if she can't breathe because she was just a baby at the time. It was just more severe in nature. But again, my first encounter with food allergies, so I didn't really know what was bad and what was good. But then as she became a little bit older, we noticed even more allergic reactions and more severe allergic reactions.
So she was allergic to a whole bunch of things.
Yes. She was allergic to milk, eggs, nuts, wheat, soy. And even at one point, she was allergic to rice. And so I had to stop eating certain things so that I can continue nursing her.
Wow.
Shellfish. the list kind of was really long and exhaustive. And there were peculiar allergies in there, things that normally kids are not allergic to. And so it was hard to find the right kinds of foods to feed her. And then when she did have a reaction, it was just so scary. She would immediately go into shock. And so she would be gasping for air and she would, be turning blue. And so there were many, many instances of that type of reaction from birth, 6 months to about age five when she...
Wow.
Yeah. When
were you fearful? Fear become a part of...
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm learning now that naturally I'm a fearful person. I don't think I really analyzed myself back then, but I think if you look at the Enneagram, it those kinds of things, I'm a type six, it says, where it's fear driven. A lot of things are driven out of fear and I just don't want, and I think maybe that was my obsession with having an easy life. I didn't want to have anything too hard happen because I wasn't sure if I can handle that. And so I was very scared for her life. We saw an allergist that told us that maybe we should consider keeping her home. Maybe school was not an option for her because of all the allergies.
Potential
she had.
Problems. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he even actually made it possible for us to go on a Make-A-Wish trip for her at that time because he felt that perhaps her life would be cut short from food allergies.
Oh my goodness, how devastating.
Yeah, so it was really hard.
What was your faith like as you were getting that kind of news?
Yeah.
What happened with your faith?
I think I became very angry at God. I think I was distant. I think I began to doubt, his goodness.
Was your husband still pastoring through this?
Yes, he was. And I think there was a little bit of bitterness there too, where I felt ministry was more important maybe than family. I don't think that was true, but in my sensitivity, I felt maybe he wasn't as there for me as I needed him to be. And his faith is very strong. And so I think that was also a point of contention where I'm how can you continue to have such strong faith, unwavering faith in the midst of such a devastating diagnosis for our daughter? But, as I'll share later, I think that was really actually the source of a really firm foundation for me to lean on him and for him to not waver in his faith because it helped me to see things. It helped that both of us were not drowning, if I can.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that was, that was a blessing.
So from 6 months to 5 years of age, dealing with the allergies, then what happened when she turned five?
So what's happening was after Ava was born, then Gwen came along about 3 years later and similar allergies.
Really?
Yeah. So... Ugh. Very similar instances. However, Gwen's was just a bit more controlled. I think maybe because we learned how to care for a child with allergies, it was a little bit better for her. We didn't see as many reactions. But then around four and a half, her allergies started kind of tapering off reaction-wise. We didn't see as many reactions. Her skin started to get a little bit better. And we just thought, wow, our prayers are finally being heard. Maybe she will outgrow these severe allergies. And I had gone back to work by that time. So I was teaching fourth grade and I was very busy. I was starting at a new school. So I felt like I needed to put, my all into it. And so I was really busy with that. And I remember her approaching me one day. It was in the winter, maybe November, December. And she said, "Mom, I have these mosquito bites on my skin." And so I took a look and I was like, "Well, that's interesting. They do look like little mosquito bites in the middle of winter." But I was so busy that I just kind of dismissed it. And she also mentioned, "Oh, my joints hurt a little bit." Like, growing pains. And so I took her to the doctor, and again, they said, yep, those are growing pains. It's about the age when they get them. And so again, I just put that to the side as well. Mm-hmm. And then in February, she came down with she came down with these fevers that were very, very high. They were about 105. Yeah. And she came, and she also had a skin lesion that was on her skin that was not going away. And so we took her into the doctor, and they took a look at that, and they thought it was maybe MRSA. So they mm-hmm. sent us home with some antibiotics, and we tried that for a few days, but just persistent fevers. So mm-hmm. I took her back in, and they admitted her, and they took some blood counts, and they found that her white blood count was, you know, off the charts, so high. And that's how they came to realize that she had leukemia. So after hearing that, I didn't really know much about leukemia at all. And they told me that there are two types of leukemia. They said there is ALL, which is very easily curable. Many of the children get that type of leukemia. And it's about like a 95% cure rate, which still, you know, hearing your child has cancer was just so devastating.
Yeah.
And then they said there's AML, which is a 50% chance of survival. And they reassured me, it was during the weekend, so it's very bare bones staff during the weekend, and they assured us that it's most likely the ALL type, and that she would be well taken care of, and that she would be fine. It's scary, but you know, we'll get you through this. And so with that, we kind of just hunkered down for those few days. But I remember, you know, when they had taken me to the back room, to the quiet room where they tell us these terrible things, I just remember feeling shock, you know, just how could that happen? Like, she's already been through such a difficult childhood. How could this happen? So we waited the weekend out, and the doctor came in. So they were saying, you know, it's most likely ALL leukemia, B-cell ALL. And then the next day they did a little bit more kind of looking at the cells, and they came back and they reported, actually, we think this is AML leukemia. So you have a choice at this point to either stay here. This is at Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, or if you want to move your child to Lurie's, which is the bigger children's hospital in Chicago, we support that, because with this type of leukemia, you will likely need a bone marrow transplant, and we don't do that here. So we're just scrambling, and we decided, okay, we're going to take her to Lurie's, and we packed her up. The ambulance came. We got her there, and she was very sick at the time. The first day there, they also looked at her leukemia, her cancer cells, and they reported back that it's actually not B-cell ALL or AML. It's a combination of both. And it's a combination of the poor diagnosis for ALL, because remember, there's a 95% chance of cure rate. Well, the 5% that pass usually have something called T-cell ALL. And then she also has AML. So it's called biphenotypic, where you have two types, and it's very rare. There's not really a tried and true method for that. So that when I heard that, what happened was I went to a quiet room, and I sat down and I screamed. I just was on the floor, and I just let out like a loud cry of desperation. And I remember, you know, after I cried all my tears and I came out, the floor was quiet because everyone had heard just the grief, you know. And so there we were at Lurie Children's Hospital, just told that our daughter had a very poor prognosis, and that they would start treatment, but they didn't even know which treatment to start with.
In that time in that back room and crying out, did you have any thoughts toward God in that moment?
I was mad.
I bet.
Yeah, I was very mad. I was scared too. I think I was most scared because I just couldn't imagine my life without Ava. And it's funny, or maybe not so funny, that prior to all of this happening, about 3 months before Ava was diagnosed, I had a friend who whose daughter also had lymphoma. Mm-hmm. And so she had already started her journey about a year prior to that. And she had posted about how her daughter, they had run out of options for her daughter. And they said, you know, please pray for us, because we just got back the report that the cancer is back and there's nothing that
they can do. And I remember I hit the floor in my bedroom and I just cried out to the Lord and I said, how could you do that? How could you allow a mom to have to bury her child? And I remember distinctly praying for this little girl and telling God, I could never do that. I could never, like, mark my words, I could never do that. And then 3 months later, Ava was diagnosed. I was at a point in my faith where I just felt like I couldn't trust him anymore.
Esther had told God what she couldn't handle, and yet she was now in that very situation. Part two of her story is coming up, but first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute.
Hi, I'm Habib Habib. Today, I want to share another quote from a book I'm writing about Joseph's story as it parallels my own story. The book will be completed soon. Here's the quote. Joseph did not tear others down in order to lift himself up. When one reads the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, it becomes very apparent that everywhere he landed, Joseph did his best and helped people around him. He served with a gentle and humble heart. We can apply that to our own lives and live by the credo, whether it's with our spouses, our siblings, our children, our co-workers, really with everyone. Life is not a year after year of competition. Servant leadership is a powerful model of leadership, and it was modeled by none other than Jesus himself. I learned that a long time ago, but I have to keep reminding myself that servant leadership was modeled by Jesus, and I need to be a servant leader. I hope you can be inspired to do the same. Read more at HabibHabib.com.
And now part two of Esther Lee's story.
So that moment in that back room, that's just a few days after she was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. What happened next in that journey?
So everything happened pretty quickly after that. We had to go right into treatment. And so we stayed about 3 weeks that first stay at the hospital. It was just really hard. I don't know if there's another word for it. We had to shave Ava's hair. And then in the process of it, I ended up cutting my own hair, chopping my own hair off.
Because, can you tell that story? I think I read that yeah. Facebook. Do you mind telling that story?
Oh yeah, no problem. So with chemotherapy, your hair tends to fall out. It's just kind of attacking the whole body. We thought it was a little bit kind of traumatizing for her to be losing clumps of hair. And so a lot of cancer patients end up shaving their head so they don't have to go through the process. They can just be done. And so we decided to do that for Ava as well, to kind of cut her hair and get it to a point where she didn't have to see clumps of hair everywhere. But I felt really guilty about her going through that by herself. And so one day, you know, right after we cut her hair, I slipped out and I went to the nearest I don't know, salon, and I asked the person to just cut my hair just straight off. And I had my hair in a ponytail, and he's like, what style would you like? And I said, no style. And I just looked down, and he probably thought I was crazy because I'm asking him to just chop my hair at the nape of the neck. But it was too hard for me to explain that story to him. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to get it done with. And so he's like, it's really hard to cut like thick hair, you know, like that. So he was just cutting right at the ponytail line, and I'm crying, and he's not sure what to do.
Oh,
yeah. And so you know, I paid him for this really ugly cut. Oh. I look like Lord Farquaad from Shrek.
Oh my gosh. That is a bad haircut.
It's really bad. And I went back, and I just remember like just crawling back into bed and, you know, waiting for her to wake up the next morning. And the next morning she looked at my hair and she started to cry. She said, what did you do to your hair? And I said, oh, honey, I wanted to have, you know, like my hair short like yours. And she's like, no, I loved your hair. And she didn't want, you know, me to even, and that's the thing about Ava. She was so always looking out for others and never really willingly sharing her pain. I feel like many people, especially as adults, we kind of get a little bit more whinier and, you know, we like to complain. And so when something bad is happening, we want others to feel that pain, mm-hmm. right? And for her, she was so mature. She just went through the pain without really wanting us to share in it. She was upset if we had to experience any of the types of things that she had to go through. So I remember, like, along those lines, I remember one time she was in the ICU. So I was laying with her in the bed and she was hooked up to all these wires. They were just kind of soft, bendable wires, but she had them everywhere. And she also had her IVs. Like, she had many connection points into her body. And when I woke up, I guess I had been sleeping on one of her wires and it had left a mark on my arm. And she looked at my arm and she was so upset. She's like, "Oh, Mom, you're hurt here. Like, you shouldn't have laid in bed with me. Look, you're hurt." And I just remember, like, just feeling that extra, like, pain of losing a child like this, you know, a child. You mean, losing any child is painful, but she was just really special to me. Yeah.
What was her faith like walking through this? I know for a child, it may be hard to know.
I think going back to what I said about her before, she was very mature and she was very special. I think her relationship with Christ began very early on. I remember when she was about maybe before her diagnosis, maybe four, every night before bed, I would pray for her and Gwen, and I would pray, and in my prayer, I would always say, and you know, God, may she choose you one day, you know, choose Christ one day, because my faith is my own and I want to impart it unto her, but she needs to be the one to choose you. And so I would always say, and may Ava and Gwen choose you one day. I remember one day after praying that, she said, "You know, I think you can stop praying that for me now. I've chosen Christ." Yeah. So
what a kid.
So she had chosen Christ around, I want to say, four. Yeah. She just always had a very strong faith. Even the things that she would share with me, the things that she would say to encourage me were very spirit-filled. And many people saw that in her. That's why I think they were enamored by her, not just because she was articulate but and like funny, but because she had a very deep faith. And I know that towards the end, she got scared.
As sure.
I think children are allowed to be, you know. And so she asked me, she said, "You know, when I pass away, when I die, what if I don't go to heaven?" And she said, "I'm scared." And I said, "Oh, Ava, like, if you believe in God and if you, you know, choose Christ, there's no way you won't be with God in heaven." And I remember her saying, okay, Mama. But it really made me, it was really hard for me to hear that. And so a few days later, I revisited it. And I said, "Ava, I just want to encourage you that, you know, when you go home, you'll be in heaven." And she's like, "Oh, Mom," she said, "don't worry. I'm not scared anymore." And so just within her own heart, within a few days, she was able to take the truth and hold it. And yeah.
I was reading, I think it was one of your blog posts, a conversation that you had when Ava asked one day, I don't know if this was where in the journey this was, but she asked if you would remember her.
Yeah. So this was actually at the very end of her journey, probably a week before she passed away. She was sleeping a lot and we were in bed together because I slept with her. I wanted to sleep with her as long as I could. We were snuggling up and she was sleeping and she kind of woke up. And towards the end of the the dying process, you actually end up sleeping a lot because your body is shutting down and it just doesn't have the energy anymore. And so she was sleeping a lot of her day away, but then she woke up and briefly had a conversation with me and she told me that she would send me butterflies. She said, "Mama, I'm going to send you butterflies." And I remember feeling like, "Oh my God, Ava, I went your whole life not realizing you like butterflies." And she's like, no, Mom, I don't like butterflies, but I'm going to send you butterflies." And so I don't know where she heard about something like that. I mean, she was just eight. And I don't know where, you know how we talk about how, you know, a butterfly is a symbol of our loved one. There's no way she heard of that anywhere. And so I don't know why she said that. But in that conversation, she had said, "I'm going to send you butterflies." So I knew that she was already shifting her mindset, like that she won't be here any much longer. Yeah. And then after that, she said, she just turned to me. And she had, throughout this time, she would wistfully look at her siblings, you know, as they were playing around her bed. And I remember just kind of looking around and then looking up at me and saying, "Mama, will you remember me when I'm gone?" And I tried so hard not to lose it, because how do I tell her that I'll remember her? Because that means I'm acknowledging that she's going. But how, you know, how could I not remember her? You know, and so I tried the best that I could to just kind of keep all my emotions in. And I said, "Of course, how could I ever forget you? I'm going to write about you. I'm going to tell the whole world about you."
And then she closed her eyes and went back to sleep. And I just left the room and I lost it. Yeah. So this is my way of remembering her.
If we go back to that moment initially in that back room and dealing with the diagnosis and your faith being probably as low as it could get, maybe it could go lower, but we're pretty low at that point. What was the faith trajectory like for you as you walked through this? Because her illness was 3 years?
Yeah.
More than 3 years long. Was there any point along the way where you thought maybe she was going to beat it?
Yeah. So it was a very, very up and down journey. After Lurie's, after her initial treatment, they started with the ALL treatment and found that that was not working. So they switched to the AML treatment and they were hoping that that would get her into remission and possibly allow her not to have to do a bone marrow transplant. Because if you think about it, 50% is still a good percentage. I mean, it was a little lower than that because of her diagnosis, but they were hoping that with chemo, she would beat it. And we found that it was just, her cancer was persistent. It was persistent in a small amounts, but enough where the doctors were getting concerned with whether or not she would beat it with just chemotherapy. And so that was when we started to look at some transplant hospitals. So she wasn't going to get a traditional bone marrow transplant because in the bone marrow registry, there's not a lot of Asian registrants. And so that's like a whole nother topic where we need more, registrants in the bone marrow registry of different ethnicities. And you need a perfect match in order to have the transplant go well. And we couldn't find that. So we needed to move to something called a cord blood transplant, where you take a baby's cord blood and it doesn't have to match as perfectly because cord blood is a little bit more naive in nature. And so it can kind of go into a host with a little bit more leniency. So we decided, okay, we're going to go to Seattle Children's Hospital because they have a really great cord blood transplant program. And so we flew our whole family to Seattle. And before we left, I remember thinking like we had made a pro and con list to measure Seattle against some of the other hospitals closer to us. Like there was one in Ohio, there was one in St. Louis, and we just kind of had to do a pro and con list. And all of those other hospitals actually had a more robust pro list, but we just felt really called to go to Seattle. Yeah. And so we ended up packing our bags and going there. And it was a very difficult journey for her because with the cord blood transplant, it actually requires you to be fully, for your existing bone marrow to be fully, I guess, killed off is the best way to say it. They do this radiation where they just get rid of your whole existing bone marrow system. And so it was 3 days of intense radiation. So this type of radiation is where even if you survive it, there will be lots of things will be stunted, your growth, your brain development, your fertility, you no longer can have children. And I remember those things were so heavy for me to accept. But in exchange for her life, we were willing to go forward with it. And so she got the bone marrow transplant. We were in the hospital for about, I want to say 6 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. Yeah. And she came out in full remission. I know, it was so, so wonderful. And so after that happened, they want you to stay near the hospital for another 3 months or so, so that if there are any complications, because it's not just like, oh, you had transplant, you can go home. Your body is pretty much wrecked from all the radiation that you received and all the chemotherapy you received. And so there's a lot of after effects that need to be taken care of. And so we were in Seattle staying in this cute little apartment above someone's garage. And it was the four of us, but I was heavily pregnant with Jude at the time. And so as such great memories because there we finally became a family of five and all of our hopes and dreams were just right there, just so within reach. Because if we had just, if we can just finish our 3 months here, then we can go back to Chicago and begin our lives again, And so we did so many just family things there. We just spent all this time together. We would go on little walks with Ava. We would go to the playground. We would, just have so many home-cooked meals. We just did just so many wonderful memories in that span of time. And then we got to go home and they're like, okay, you're clear to go. And so we went home and we were so ecstatic. And at home, we enjoyed another 6 months of just carefree days of just hoping,
okay, now next year Ava's going to go into, you know, second grade and it's going to be great. And just as we were about to go into the hospital at our 1 year anniversary of her transplant, we went into the hospital to pull her one of the lines that she had to her heart because we didn't need it anymore. But we had noticed at that time that there was a little bit of like, almost like a little skin growth. I'll think back to the mosquito bites that I mentioned earlier. Skin growth. And so we thought, oh, it's nothing. You know, it's maybe it's like an ingrown pimple or something. And we didn't expect the doctors to say anything about it. But when they saw it, they were like, oh, we need to biopsy that. So there we were again, thrown right into the ring where we thought we were finally, we went there to take out.
To be done.
The last, you know, thing that we needed before we can live our normal lives again. And in that same surgery that they were taking this out, they were biopsying that lump and it came back cancerous. So we were thrown right back into the fight. So how was my faith? Well, I would say that during the time of, you know, diagnosis to transplant, my faith grew leaps and bounds, where I just kept seeing God's provision everywhere. You know, and like I had mentioned, when we went to Seattle, our list was so short, our pro list was so short because we didn't have friends there. We didn't know a single soul. The winters were going to be dreary and we knew that we were going to be there during the winter. But God had provided so graciously the weather. That was one of the driest months that Seattle had known, and so, or driest winters. So there was sun pouring into the window every single day that we were in the hospital. And the types of people he brought into our lives at the time, this is why I can't say that God has abandoned me, because of the people he brought alongside us, like so gracious and kind and generous. And so my faith just kept feeling like it was being fed. And I felt like even though it was the hardest time of my life, I came out so like fat, like, you know, like so well fed in my faith and in my soul. Oh, here's the other magical thing that happened. All her allergies went away. Yes.
As a result of the transplant. Of the transplant?
The transplant.
So could she eat?
Everything.
All the things she'd never been able to eat.
Ice cream, cake, everything she had always wanted to try, she got to eat. Yeah. It was, they called it a reboot. They're like, it's almost like she received a reboot. So that's when my faith was just so, it had grown so much, because I thought, oh, this is the reason, God, this is the reason you brought her through all of that, so that she can now live a life where we don't have to fear death because of food allergies. Mm-hmm. So that's what I thought was the purpose. And then the other shoe dropped.
So when they biopsy and they come back and say it's cancer.
Yeah.
What happened to your faith in that? You were at a different place, though.
Yeah, I was. I think because I had seen the goodness of God so blatantly in my life during that 1 year, that going into the second part, I felt really well equipped. I felt like, okay, you know, I think we can do this. And so we actually waited out her waited it out. There's something called like watch and wait, because it was such a minute amount of cancer and it was just in her skin. Because of that, the doctors felt like if we didn't want to go into another aggressive bone marrow transplant, we could just give it some time and see what would happen, if her new immune system would find it and get it, or if it would grow. And so we did a little bit of watching and waiting, and we just tried to enjoy every single day of life during that time. And my faith, again, was very strong. I just felt like God is going to get us through this. Then it just kind of started, then the cancer started growing, and then it was in her. And so we decided, okay, it's time to start treatment. So we flew back to Seattle and started her on chemotherapy again. That's kind of where we started to realize that maybe things wouldn't turn out as like we had planned it for it to turn out. But throughout that time, Ava would constantly say to us, you know, as we were praying for her, she would say, you know, Mom, but if it doesn't turn out like we planned, God's ways are still higher than ours.
This is as a 8-year-old child.
Yeah. I didn't understand it either. So mature. I think she really had the Holy Spirit in her, protecting her and just fighting for her. So
I remember distinctly one day we were driving somewhere and we were praying for her healing. And we said, you know, even if, you know, if God answers our prayers, then we'll praise him. And we started to clap. The whole, you know, me and the kids and Mike were like, well, we will applaud him for his goodness. But if God doesn't answer our prayer, we'll still applaud him because we know that he's good and that where you're going is good. And I think there was a shift there where we were celebrating whatever outcome we have, it's going to be okay.
So at Seattle, they found that her tumors had grown so much. And so they said, you know, there's nothing more we can do for you here. I think you should take her home. And so, especially if it's important for her to be around her relatives and family, friends. So we decided, okay, we're going to go home, but we're not going to give up. We're going to actually go to Wisconsin and we're going to try for another transplant there. It's called a haploid, where they could take a parent and see if a parent matches. And I turned out to be a match and I was so happy. I felt like for the first time ever, I had a little bit of say in what was going on. And I knew that my immune system, if once it went into her, it would fight for her. You know, I just like, I know that's illogical, but that's how I felt. And I was so excited for the chance. And every time they would pull blood, you know, vials and vials of blood, I thanked God that I could actually understand a little bit of what Ava felt as she was getting all of her blood work done all the time. In any case, we went to Wisconsin with this hope that maybe this is like our last chance. Maybe God will answer our prayer here. And I think that is where I did a lot in my posts. I talk a lot about how the bathroom floor is so holy, you know, the holiness of a hospital floor. And I think that's where I did a lot of crying out to God. I would put Ava to sleep and I would go into the bathroom and I would just lay on the floor and just pour out my heart before God. That's when I felt so near to the Lord, just like as if he was right there next to me on that hospital floor, crying with me. And so my faith, even though it was shaky, I felt like I wasn't alone, and I wasn't. And I think that was when really the imagery of Jesus being with me, not up high, but down low, was very apparent. And our time in Wisconsin was short. There was a time that came where they said, we can't do anything for her anymore. And I signed the do not resuscitate papers. And we took her home. And she had a good maybe 2 weeks at home before she went to be with the Lord. And during that time, I remember we had to start bringing in some more of the hospice type of equipment, like the oxygen tanks and things like that. And I remember writing about this too, how the oxygen tank, the sound of it breathing for her made me so mad, you know, like, how did we get here? And I remember wanting to just be dramatic and take everything off my dresser, just fling it to the floor like in the movies and just shout out to God and swear at him and say, you know, how am I here? I just couldn't understand how I was at a point where I had to say goodbye to Ava. I was angry at God, but I think I felt very safe in my anger. By now, I felt like he could handle my anger. My anger doesn't mean that I don't have faith. It just means that I have emotion, and God gave me that emotion. And God understands that emotion. And he's okay with the fact that I'm upset. And you know, that whole experience actually really helped me to understand the Father's heart in a way I never could understand it before. You know, that he willingly allowed Jesus not only to die, but to suffer and die for someone like me. I'm not that good. And I told, you know, I would have a lot of people writing in and telling me, oh, you know, like, our faith has grown so much because of Ava. And I remember saying, I don't care about your faith. I care about my daughter. You know, you are a grown person. You can work out your faith with Jesus. But I don't want to sacrifice my daughter for anyone's faith. That's how selfish I was. I didn't want Ava's suffering and death to bless others more than I just wanted Ava.
Right.
You know, I just wanted her. And so, yeah, it just really helped me to understand God's immense love and sacrifice for us in a way I would never have known before. And to kind of circle back to the beginning, you know, how had I envisioned my life? I envisioned truly a life that was beautiful, you know, with
in the sense of what the world says is beautiful, white picket fence, you know, like children that are happy and healthy, you know, a dog, I don't know, serving God, but only knowing the joys of serving God and not the hardships. And toward the end, you know, my faith now is, I realized like I had wanted a comfortable life, knowing Jesus, but living on my terms. Now I realize that knowing Jesus is good enough. I don't need to have my terms. I don't need to have things go my way. And I think I'm not at this like, you know, I'm enlightened and now I'm, you know, nothing bothers me anymore. Quite the opposite. I think in a lot of ways, I'm very, life is hard. Life is really hard because I see, you know, things around me that are a little bit more, everything I see in like, in a meaningless sense where things feel really meaningless to me. All these things that we strive for feel meaningless. And then me, as I'm starting to get back into the real world and I see that I start to want some of those meaningless things, that feels, you know, upsetting to me. And so, yeah, I'm not at this point where I'm like, now just, you know, just a pure,
super person, spiritual,
super spiritual, holy person. No, I realize that I am so, so need Jesus so much more, you know, in my life now than ever before, as he's exposed all of these different things in me that require the surgery of Christ in me to, yeah, to become more like him.
I think for somebody listening to your story, I think you're living out for many of us, especially if you're a mom, it's your greatest fear.
Yeah.
Right? That's worst case scenario,
yeah.
Right? You can do this, God, you can do the, all kinds of
right.
tragedies you'd trade for this, not this, Lord. And so, and probably there are many people listening who've walked through this and, you know, just this, the challenge of grieving and holding on to God. The thing that I read, you wrote, I'm confronted by the complicated truth that sometimes our very good God allows very bad things to happen, including the death of firstborns.
Yeah.
That's the point of wrestling, I think, for many of us when we hear stories like this or you live a story like this. It's like, how do you grieve something like this and hold on to God?
Yeah, I think there is a verse that I have held on to ever since Ava passed away. And of course, now I can't remember the actual reference, but it's hope anchors the soul. And I think that it's in Hebrews, I believe. And isn't that the truth? I think without the hope that everything will make sense one day, that what Ava had shared, you know, God's ways are better than our ways. We know that that is true, but we just can't see it yet. And I think the hope that one day we will be in on the secret of why things transpired the way that they did, that's what spurs me on every day in my grief to get up and to keep moving. Because, boy, wouldn't that be just the greatest day ever when we get to stand before God. And I think when I stand before God, I always thought my question would be, why did you let that happen? But I wonder if it'll just be, wow, wow, I never imagined that's what you were doing behind the scenes. So I think grieving with hope is so important as a Christian. We should never get rid of the grieving. The grieving is there because we lost something so important to us. And it's there because God gave us that emotion to grieve. But without hope, it's desperation. But we grieve with the hope that one day all things will be made new and that all the broken things will be fixed and all the lost things will be found, including my daughter.
There have been a number of interviews I've done for this podcast that when I finished, I felt like I was treading on holy ground. Page 24, Megan Thompson's story, and certainly Esther and Ava's story feels this way. I think what I find so moving is that in these situations, which seem like worst case scenario, what these women speak of is the creator of the universe is with you, not distant, not far away, but in Esther's words, laying on the bathroom floor, crying with her. That gives me hope that no matter what's ahead for you or for me, God is going to be with us in a way that we can see and we can feel. And maybe that hope is a small part of Ava's legacy, this assurance of our faith, and that one day everything sad will come untrue. Thanks to Esther for sharing her story. She is, by the way, a really talented writer. Her posts on the Team Brighter Days Facebook page are thoughtful and they're moving. And if you'd like to know more about Ava's story, you might want to check that out. And Esther shared one more really cool story of how God showed up for them in their grief. If you hang out to the very end of the podcast today, you're going to be glad you did.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks so much to producer Jason Rackow and our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Find encouragement to develop the full power of your leadership potential at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll take next week off and then be back with another page in The Unfolding.
This was like such a phenomenal story of how we felt God heard us and answered in such a crazy way. Do you want to hear it?
I do. Yeah.
So after Ava passed away, we did a lot of traveling because in my spirit, I was so restless. I needed to get away. And so we were gifted this, so generous. My brother helped us to go to Hawaii and just kind of relax and rest for a little bit. And Gwen was there. And Gwen, I didn't talk enough about Gwen on here, but she is such a sweet, sweet girl. And her connection with Ava was so, so strong. They called each other super special best friends, like super sister special best friends.
Oh.
They had their own language. I mean, they had a lot of connection. And when Ava passed away, Gwen told me, she said, now it's just me alone in this world. No one will teach me anything anymore, because she had depended so much on Ava. In any case, we went to Hawaii and she had taken Ava's one of Ava's chemo hats that was really special to her, and she had taken it to Hawaii. And they were playing in the ocean. Suddenly, a wave out of nowhere came up so quickly, took the hat, and just took it out to sea. And so we were just standing there like, oh my goodness, it's gone, you know? And so Gwen came running up to me. She's sobbing. She's like, that's, and she was, you know, she was only five at the time, and she was really dramatic. She's like, oh, that was all I had left of my sister, and now it's gone. And she's just crying and crying. And we were all crying at this point because we knew that it wasn't just the hat. It was about the fact that we're finally like grieving the fact that Ava's gone. And Mike prayed and he said, let's just pray. Let's just tell God that we're feeling so sad right now. So he prayed. He said, God, we are so sad, not just about this hat, but because we don't have Ava anymore. And this hat was really meaningful to us, especially to Gwen. But now it's gone. And he said, but we know that you know where everything is in life. And you know that where this hat is, you know where Ava is, you know, you see us here on earth crying. And I just want to tell you that we're really sad. And so he ended his prayer. And then he said, I want to go look for the hat. And I said, Mike, you're crazy. We saw it go out to the ocean. It's gone. Let's just leave it alone. And I was afraid he's going to try and swim out there and then I'd lose him. Yeah. And I was just not happy with it. But he's like, let me just go. I just want to just at least feel like I tried. So I said, okay, fine. So he ran, you know, along the shoreline, and then he disappeared around the bend. And so I was like, okay, well, now, you know, we'll just wait. And so we were waiting. About 20 minutes later, he came running back again without the hat. And in my head, I'm thinking, see, why did you leave? Now I had to care for her by myself. She's crying and I had to console her by myself. And he came back and he's crying. And so he gave Gwen a hug and he said, Gwen, I want you to give me a hug. So she gave him a hug. And then she's like, you know, hugging him and they're consoling each other. And he goes, Gwen, I want you to just like, you know, take your arms and just go a little bit lower on my back. And so she just kind of patted down and she grabbed, he had tucked the hat right behind. She grabbed it. She said, where did you get this hat? And so he told us the story. So he was running along the shoreline with his eyes on the water, crying and saying, God, I don't know where this hat is, but you know where this hat is. And he's like making his way. And suddenly he hears someone coming out of the water, waving the hat, saying, whose hat is this?
Oh my!
Is this someone's hat? And he saw that, he looks up and there's a man walking out of the water with the hat over his head. And Mike says, that's my daughter's hat. And again, this is like 15 minutes away from where we are. The waves had carried it that far. And he said, how did you find this hat? The man said, I was swimming way out there. And as I was swimming, it just collided with my face. And so I we're thinking, okay, well, first of all, what are the chances he would bump into the hat? Second of all, who brings garbage from the ocean
back in with him?
And he had, and I said, Mike, did you tell him the story of why this was so significant? And Mike's like, no, I didn't. Of course. So I said, we have to go back and we have to thank him and we have to tell him the story. So we went back, and Mike's description of this man was very specific. Bald, but hairy everywhere else. And so, you know, it was so funny. And so we were like, okay, well, I'm sure we won't find anyone like him. It should be easy. So we went, and sure enough, there were like two or three bald men that were hairy. And so we went up to each of them and we said, were you the one that found this hat? And they're like, no, we don't know what you're talking about. And so we went up and down that beach where Mike had found the hat. We couldn't find the man. So cool.